The opinions expressed by guests of this show are their own and do not necessarily align with those of us here at the Animal Soulmates podcast.
And we also did a little bit of a study, and I shouldn't say little, it was about 2,000 people, pet owners, that we surveyed to see what are the top four things that are important to you and how you would define good euthanasia, right? Not even just good death, but good euthanasia. And what ranked very high in the top four was help with pre-planning. Right? What are our choices around euthanasia, memorial items, who can be there, where can we be, and all of those things. So I'll come back around to that original concept here, is that knowledge reduces fear, it helps to empower, and it really does level out the emotion and the concerns around death. It's not going to take away the sadness, let's be clear, but it's going to level out the emotions and the anxiety that can come around death.
Welcome to the Animal Soulmates podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Abby Viscardi. I'm an animal welfare scientist and, more importantly, an obsessed dog mom. I believe that the unconditional love and connection that we share with our animals is more powerful than we realize. This podcast will honor the stories of these amazing creatures that have walked with us and changed our lives forever. So join me, and together we will explore the true power of the human-animal bond. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Animal Soulmates podcast. Frank enjoyed his second time as co-host, and I was really glad to have him around for this one too. Today, I'm chatting with Dr. Kathleen Cooney. Dr. Cooney is a veterinarian certified in both hospice and palliative care, as well as peaceful euthanasia. She's a researcher and educator at Colorado State University, with her focus on determining best clinical practices for end-of-life care for our pets. She founded CADA, the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy, whose mission is to provide outstanding education in companion animal euthanasia to improve the overall experience for the pet, caregiver, and veterinary team. You guys, I know the last thing we want to think about is the loss of our pets, but Dr. Cooney makes a very strong case for why it's important so that we can do everything possible to honor the human-animal bond right up until the end, and even beyond. We do speak a lot about euthanasia and end of life in this one, so it may be a hard one to listen to, especially if you're raw in your grief of losing a pet. But I hope that many of you find it helpful in determining what you want for your pet and what best honors them when their journey's coming to an end and they're preparing to cross the rainbow bridge. And I do hope that conversations like this relieve some of that anxiety and fear surrounding euthanasia. So here we go with episode 6, a veterinarian specializing in end-of-life care with Dr. Kathleen Cooney.
Hi, listeners. I am Dr. Kathleen Cooney. I'm a veterinarian here in beautiful Colorado, and I've been a veterinarian now since 2004, so going on almost 20 years. And here in Colorado, I'm known as a euthanasia and end-of-life specialist. I've definitely focused my career on that over the past, probably 17 years now. And I spend my day mostly writing about euthanasia and end-of-life best practices. I do a lot of research, and I'm still able to help families with euthanasia appointments. So I'm sitting here in my little comfort center in Northern Colorado, where families come to me for end-of-life appointments, in particular euthanasia, but sometimes quality of life talks and quality of life assessments to decide if it's the right time for euthanasia. And when I'm not doing that work, I also teach at Colorado State University, where I instruct on euthanasia, best practices, and a bit on hospice care. And then I also teach the animal welfare course, and I have done that for a few years now for the second year veterinary students. And that's been a real joy as I'm working on being a boarded specialist in animal welfare, and hopefully we'll receive that here within the next year or so to be a specialist in that. And I just love all things old and gray. That's usually what I say, that as animals are reaching the end of their life, I want to make that journey as beautiful as possible.
And so can you talk a little bit about what drew you to a career in veterinary medicine initially?
Yeah, it had nothing to do with end of life, which I think is unique. So I definitely grew up with a menagerie of animals, as many veterinarians do. We had a couple of horses, Great Danes. We really went big with the dogs, cats, and some rabbits and guinea pigs over the years. So I've always loved animals. And I think equally important to that is I've always loved people. And I love people who love animals. So it was a good fit. But I didn't find my path towards vet med until later. I would say I was maybe 21 thereabouts. So just as a kid, as a teen, just of course loved animals, loved horses in particular, and found myself working for a ranch down in Tennessee for a while, right when I was around 20, early 21. And I really enjoyed working with the veterinarian there at that horse ranch in Tennessee. And I thought, this guy's got it figured out. You know, he's a mobile vet, gets to go around and work with these beautiful, wonderful horses and these good people, and he's well respected in the community. And it really kind of woke up a medicine bug in me, and then restoked the love of science. And so I ended up going back to college at that point. I'd kind of started a little bit of college early on, right after high school, but just really wasn't for me at the time. And with this veterinarian's help, decided to go back to college and landed in Colorado. I'm actually born and raised in Michigan. And so I'd been cruising around for a while before finding my calling for vet med and decided to come out to Colorado State for that education. So I originally was going to be a horse vet. I had no inclination to focus in on end of life. That came later after graduation when I got into private practice at about a 7-doctor hospital in Michigan. Went back to Michigan for a little bit after graduation. And it was interesting there. It was an interesting experience because I noticed after a while that my daily schedule had more euthanasias in it, I think, than my colleagues did. And whether or not my technicians realized what they were doing, I think they were naturally kind of helping to schedule up euthanasias for me. Because when I was walking out of those appointments, I seemed to be just as balanced and just as, you know, kind of stable as when I went in, or perhaps even better, right? An opportunity to slow down, to make a connection with families, especially as a new graduate. Something was just clicking. Something was really that perfect rhythm and recipe for me to be able to support families and listen to stories and everything that I love really about vet med, and really be present for the human-animal bond. And also in that work, I started to kind of test out what home euthanasia would be like. So when I was at that practice, you know, how could I go to the home and help out some families? And I really, really connected with that. So long story short is that I thought I was going to be an equine vet to start, and then still love horses, but didn't like the medicine, ended up navigating towards this career of end of life, in large part in gratitude to my staff at that hospital that I was working with in Michigan, and then eventually starting a home euthanasia service here in Colorado, and everything just took off.
I think it's so important to hear that part of your story too, because we talk to our veterinary students here about, you just never know where you're going to end up in your career. You may think you're going to do small animal, and then you find yourself in a completely different direction. So I think that that's a perfect example of where your career, you think it's going to go one way and it zags the other way.
And it zags the other way, and not to fight it, right? Not to go into anything with a preconceived notion that this is how it has to be. In fact, during senior year, I loved every single rotation that I was in at the hospital, whether it was oncology or dermatology to surgery. I just loved it all. I was open to all of it. So it made sense for me to go into general practice and, you know, really get my skills built up there with wonderful mentorship, and then let that experience start to sculpt what the future will hold. And lo and behold, it was end of life.
Was there a particular moment or a particular situation that kind of drew you to focus your career on end of life?
I had a patient that I had been treating at this hospital in Michigan with lymphoma. He had lymphoma, and I'd been caring for him for many months. We'd been really quite successful with the palliative care for him because lymphoma, we know, can be short, a short disease trajectory of maybe just a couple of months. But we'd done pretty well with him, a little bit of chemotherapy and other things. And he had one of those difficult ends, though, where on, I think it was a Sunday, where the family called me. I was on call for the weekend for the hospital, and they called me and they said that he is really taking a turn for the worse. He's struggling to breathe, and he's basically in a crisis. So I invited the family to meet me at the hospital because I hadn't started to work into home euthanasia services yet. Invited them to meet me at the hospital. It was all we could do to get him into the lobby, right? From the vehicle into the lobby, basically collapsed there on the lobby floor. And I went to him with my meds, my drugs to help him. And I'll be honest, it wasn't my smoothest euthanasia. I was still relatively new to vet med, and I had only been out for probably a year. And we don't get a lot of good euthanasia education in vet school, which is my main mission these days, is to try to change that. But I was one of those graduates of a school that didn't teach a lot about euthanasia. So I had to learn on the fly. And from my colleagues. And this was a unique situation. Here was a dog in front of me that was struggling to breathe, chest full up of fluid, hard to find those veins. I really didn't know much of what to do. So I just did the best that I could. But what I remember walking away from that appointment is I kept my compassion and I kept my calmness. And that's really what the family needed at that moment, because he was absolutely their heart dog. And then I knew that I had to improve my skills, right? So what do you do with a patient like that? You create a legacy from it and ask yourself, how can I do better, right? What can I learn? What can I improve upon to help other dogs like him or other cats or other horses, whatever it might be? And from that day on, I knew that I could do better. And so I started to learn and I started to ask the question, could I have helped this dog at home, right? Could I have made it where I go to him instead of him coming to me? And that's really probably where the spark came from, was that realization that that dog didn't need to pass on the lobby floor of the hospital. He could have been at home. And then I started to think about, well, when it's time for me to move back to Colorado from Michigan, I always knew that I wanted to stay in Colorado. It just wasn't the right fit right after I graduated. And what could I do back in Colorado that wasn't a service that wasn't being met, a need in the community that wasn't being filled? And I thought home euthanasia, right? Home euthanasia is something that I could do. So I called a friend of mine who ran a pet crematory in Colorado. And I said, or asked, do you ever get calls for home euthanasia services? Are you aware that this is something that people might be looking for, even though she's a crematory, right? Crematories are often sources of information for end-of-life care for pets. And she shared that she got at least 4 calls a day for home euthanasia services in Northern Colorado, or who would that crematory recommend that this pet owner call? And I thought, 4 calls a day, I could help to fill that need. So I ended up starting here in Colorado back in 2006, a home euthanasia service that was 24/7, 365 days a year. And it was so well received that after 2 years of doing 24/7 mobile euthanasia work, I started to hire other doctors. And before I knew it, we had 9 doctors and 5 support staff, and we were covering a 2-hour kind of radius of travel time. And it was just absolutely wonderful. So I'm very grateful to that dog and its family that came to me on that afternoon to really ignite something in me to say, we can do things better.
That's amazing. Wow. What a legacy to start with this beautiful dog.
I still remember his name. I remember what he looked like, everything, but I'm just going to keep it quiet to myself right now. But it was a great dog, and it was a great family, and he's one to create a legacy off of.
Amazing. So as a pet owner, especially of an animal, this is an Animal Soulmate podcast. So especially when you consider this animal to be your soulmate, the last thing that we ever want to think about is end of life or euthanasia, right? Most of us can't even allow ourselves to think about it because it just brings us to a bubbling mess. Why is it important that we do think about end of life and euthanasia before we're faced with it?
Well, you said it perfectly. It's overwhelming. It brings just a lot of sadness to anyone to think about saying goodbye to such a good, dear friend, a companion, a soulmate. How do you do that? How do you take on pain when pain isn't necessary right then, right? Why can't we just put it off until that moment arrives and then make those decisions? But what I've learned over the years is that knowledge is very powerful, and knowledge eliminates fear. And many of us have fear of the unknown, fear of those last moments, the last even couple months of life. We don't really know what that's like. And even if we've gone through a death experience before, this one will be unique, right? This is a different animal. Often it's a different condition that they're going through. You know, maybe one family has a dog with cancer and now they're going through just age-related changes with a cat, right? It could be a very different experience. So for the most part, we want to put it off until we have to think about it. Well, when that happens, we're missing a lot of opportunities to create memorialization ideas and even, you know, dare I say, party planning, right? When we can have a celebration event to say goodbye to a beloved pet. More importantly, probably, is the importance of exploring what's possible for palliative medicine and hospice care as an animal nears the end. So what can we do to help to reduce pain? What can we do to help with hygiene or anxiety or breathing issues, appetite, whatever that it might be that this pet is presenting as their condition progresses? Then, you know, can we start to layer on better care to maybe provide more time? And that in and of itself can be difficult for owners to do, to say, I'm going to start looking into this now and then, you know, make sure that my pet has the best, you know, last few months of life possible. And then to open up the conversation about how they really want their pet to die. And that's a big paradigm shift, right? To just ask oneself, how do I envision my pet dying? Is it going to be natural or is it going to be through euthanasia? And there are lots of people out there, of course, way more common that euthanasia is chosen. So there's going to be more people that are familiar with euthanasia than they may be with natural death support. But it's to ask themselves, really, how do they want their pet to die? And we did a little bit of a survey on that with some of my clients over the years, and we gave them three choices to think about early on in planning. Do they want what we call hospice-supported natural death, meaning that they really don't want to choose euthanasia? They only want their pet to die naturally, so euthanasia is kind of off the table. And there's usually many reasons behind why a family would choose that. So that's one choice. And you'll notice that I didn't just say their pet to die naturally. It's with hospice-supported natural death, which is different. The second choice was they wanted a natural death, but they're open to euthanasia. And the third choice was planned euthanasia, meaning that they really didn't want their pet to die naturally. They wanted euthanasia so that they could be there, they could have the control over the last, you know, moments of life, and have that tribute in a way that was important to them, where they would be very concerned if their pet died naturally, that was their pet comfortable in those final moments where they're necessarily, again, natural death, not a lot of control. And you may be having an idea of your mind, your listeners and you, Dr. Abby, about what most families chose. And most families chose they wanted a natural death, but they were open to euthanasia. Okay? So they would prefer their pet to just pick their time and go peacefully when they were ready, but they're open to euthanasia. About 95% of families chose that. And then of those 95%, 95% chose euthanasia. So it was just goes to show that, you know, euthanasia is still extremely common these days. And so when it comes to pre-planning, talk to the family members, say, what does everybody want from this journey? And, you know, do we believe that our beloved pet is reaching the natural end of their life? And what are we going to do about it? You know, what are we going to do about it versus just hoping that things go peacefully? So in other words, getting people in more control, having them act as advocates for what's important to them, again, palliative care to hospice and that emotional support and the education about what disease looks like and what natural death is to what are our choices for euthanasia. The sky's the limit when it comes to pre-planning. And we also did a little bit of a study, and I shouldn't say little, it was about 2,000 people, pet owners, that we surveyed to say, what are the top four things that are important to you and how you would define good euthanasia, right? Not even just good death, but good euthanasia. And what ranked very high in the top four was help with pre-planning, right? What are our choices around euthanasia, memorial items, who can be there, where can we be, and all of those things. So I'll come back around to that original concept here is that knowledge reduces fear, it helps to empower, and it really does level out the emotion and the concerns around death. It's not going to take away the sadness, let's be clear, but it's going to level out the emotions and the anxiety that can come around death.
So this podcast is all about the human-animal bond and how powerful that is. And I think euthanasia is kind of something we don't talk about because we view it as a severing of that human-animal bond. And so it seems still sort of a taboo thing to discuss. But you've talked a lot about how we can make bond-centered decision-making when it comes to end-of-life care. Could you talk about that a little bit? What does that look like? How we can honor this human-animal bond even at their last moment?
Let's start by saying that it's important that pet owners and veterinarians feel comfortable to bring up the idea of euthanasia sooner than later in conversation, right, in discussions. So it's not too far-fetched to have an end-of-life discussion when a dog or a cat, whatever that it is, goes to see the veterinarian and it's very frail, right? It's advanced senior years or geriatric, which is kind of a different stage of decline towards the end. And it's okay for pet owners to start to ask questions, right? You know, how close do you think they are to the end? Or what is our options when the time comes? Meaning, you know, can we euthanize? And for veterinary teams to also feel comfortable to go there and kind of take away that taboo feeling around it and be comfortable to bring it up. And even if it doesn't feel comfortable in conversation, that veterinary teams are handing over resources about end of life, right? You know, what is euthanasia or what is animal hospice and palliative care? Just what is an end of life journey and preparation for an animal look like? To hand over those things or also putting that kind of stuff on websites. We did research a couple of years ago now looking at how many veterinary websites list euthanasia. It's less than 50% that will list euthanasia on their site as something that they offer as a service. So if we as a profession can start to put that language front and center and get it out there, I think we're going to be doing a good service then for pet owners who are curious, right? They might look at an emergency hospital's website and not even see euthanasia listed and now wonder whether or not they can bring their pet in for that. And that might help them to do so versus waiting until the next day when they can call, you know, their regular hospital or something else. So I think we do a good service by, again, leaning into the language around euthanasia. And in doing so, we honor the human-animal bond. You know, if a veterinarian and their team can say to a client, you know, I'm worried. I'm worried by what we see here, right? That their decline is going to be potentially faster than we want it to be. And I think it's important that we start talking about what end of life looks like. And has your family talked about this yet? Or would it be okay if we take a few moments and explore that together now, right? Like asking permission on such a serious topic with a client. Why I say that that protects the human-animal bond is because it puts the client in control, right? It puts them in control of a time where they don't feel like they have much control, right? How do they want that end-of-life experience to be? Do they want it you know, if they're going to choose home euthanasia, do they want it to be in the home where that really honors the human-animal bond, right? Where they can be lying in the master bed or just, you know, the primary bedroom, or they can be out in that favorite, you know, spot in the backyard next to those flowers that the dog always liked to lay next to, wherever that it is, wherever is special, that is honoring the human-animal bond versus avoiding the conversation altogether, and then the family finds themselves in crisis or in a situation where they don't have a lot of control and they don't get to say goodbye in a way that's meaningful for them. That survey that I mentioned before, where the pet owners were defining a good death, the location where they had the least successful euthanasia experiences in the past was the emergency room. So when you look at what the emergency room doesn't have compared to what a general practice would have or in the home setting, it's usually, you know, it's rushed, it is potentially more clinical, and lack of pre-planning, right? Lack of pre-planning, because it's likely a crisis event, it's a trauma, it's something like that, which means that the family didn't have that opportunity to prepare. So in other words, the more that we can empower these pet owners who love these animals to think about what's important to them and have more control, ultimately that does protect the human-animal bond.
And if you don't mind us going here, can you talk a little bit about what goes on in a euthanasia? I just think for listeners who maybe haven't experienced end of life with a pet, talking about what they can expect might actually help reduce some of that fear and anxiety that you had mentioned earlier.
Thank you. You know, and it's good to point out with that those who have gone through a euthanasia once might be facing, you know, the end of another pet's life and are preparing for that euthanasia. And it could be very different, right? Depending on the veterinary team that's working with that animal this time, or whether or not it's in the home setting or in an ER, right? There's different variables, if you will, based on, you know, who is performing the euthanasia. Even more reason then to know what normal euthanasia should look like, or better yet, what modern euthanasia looks like, so that we as pet owners could ask for what's important to us, right? To be able to go there and be your best advocate in the advocate for your own pet. So with euthanasia, let's just explore it from the general practice, typical veterinary hospital setting. That often what happens is the family, the bonded pair, whether or not that's five people with their pet or one person with their pet, is going to enter into the hospital, and they're usually welcomed into what's known as a comfort room, probably a room that the staff has designated for euthanasia that might be a little softer in its decor, in its features there, like with a couch, maybe with a rug or a mat on the ground. There should be tissue boxes and maybe water available. And there's often pictures or images of the human-animal bond. So that's kind of a typical setting for a hospital euthanasia space. That said, there might be, depending on where, you know, you as a listener are in the world, there might be just kind of a more standard exam room. And that's okay too. What's really going to come down to it is, are we slowing down during this appointment and listening and sharing stories and putting our pets' needs front and center, okay? Making sure that they're comfortable. Once everyone is gathered in that room, it's going to be often a veterinary technician or a veterinary assistant, or maybe the veterinarian themselves, who is going to talk through a few things in that moment, right? Hopefully they're going to take a bit of time to establish rapport and get to know you if this is a new, you know, relationship, get to know you a little bit, but then they're likely going to talk through some logistics, such as, you know, who might need to be notified of the death of the pet and what everyone wants for aftercare. So cremation or burial or aquamation, which is a new emerging aftercare choice, which is water-based cremation, not fire. And so there's a lot of those systems now around the world. So they might be talking about that. But in a perfect scenario, that's actually already been discussed on the phone ahead of time, or there might have been an intake form on a website where the pet owner can jot those things down, right? What's important to them? What are the options? And then what's important? So hopefully then the veterinary staff is really just confirming what's important to the pet owner. And then if payment hasn't been collected yet, payment is usually collected right after some confirmation of details in that paperwork. So a lot of hospitals now are trying to collect payment ahead of time. But if that hasn't been done, then it's usually done at that moment before the medical procedure itself begins. So whether or not, you know, when paperwork's completed and plus or minus payment, then the veterinary team will usually describe what's going to happen next, right? So whether or not the pet is going to be given what we call pre-euthanasia sedation, medications to help the pet to sleep first, and then when the pet is sleeping, to proceed with the second injection or second medicine, which will help them to die, will help them to pass. That's euthanasia. So these days in modern euthanasia, it is very typical for two medicines to be given, one first to help the pet to sleep, and then the second medicine to help them to pass. One of the changes that's happening, and I want to empower our listeners to ask for, is to keep the pet and pet owner together through all of this, right? It's still pretty common in hospitals for the pet to be brought back to the treatment area for an intravenous catheter to be placed, of which then the medicines will be given through. That means that there's a little tube placed into the vein, then those meds will be given through that. And that's often done back in the treatment area. So with my euthanasia training academy called CATA, the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy, what we advocate for is to actually do all of that in the room, so that there is no separation of the bond. One of the other things that pet owners said that was so important to them is that they don't want to be separated. They want the choice to be there through every moment of their pet's euthanasia appointment. So that just means that instead of things being done back in the treatment area, it'll be done in the room. That said, then just kind of working through the steps, their pet will be sedated, and then euthanasia will take place in whatever technique the veterinary team deems most suitable based on the pet's condition. So they might be giving the injection into the vein. It might be in another space or area of the body. It's just whatever the veterinary team thinks best. There's often privacy that is provided before that is done. So maybe when the pet is sleeping, some privacy can be offered before that euthanasia injection then is given. And there is often then privacy after death has arrived, that death has occurred. So just offering some privacy if there's time and it seems like that's important to the pet owner. And then usually there's a bit of time for the family to just sit and be present. And then once they depart, then the hospital typically handles aftercare preparations from there. So they would go ahead and now take the deceased pet and prepare it for whatever aftercare choice was made. If the family wants to take the pet home with them for burial or to make the drive to the crematory themselves, the veterinary team will help to prepare the body to then place it in the vehicle for that drive. So that's maybe a quick overview of euthanasia, and I hope that that's helpful to the listeners.
Yeah, I think it will be. It's hard not to, when you're describing what a good euthanasia looks like, to not reflect on my animal soulmate and her euthanasia and try not to get choked up about it. But it's incredibly peaceful when it's done. We had hers done at home, and she had the sedation before the euthanasia drug was given, and it was very, very peaceful. And I don't know that people necessarily know that before going into it, what a euthanasia is going to look like, but it can be a beautiful moment between you and your pet, even though it is your last moment together.
That's why we want veterinary teams to learn as much as they can about good death. In fact, that's what euthanasia means, is good death, and to have the skills, the technical skills, the medical skills, and the communication skills to deliver a peaceful ending. And I'd like to take just a moment to wrap up those four most important things of how pet owners define a good death, because it really, I think, illustrates this well. They want to be with their pet and not separated in those final moments. Now, that's not to say that everyone wants to be present for euthanasia and that it is in any way a failure to not be there for your pet's final moments, right? In fact, that's a nice thing about the sedation or that sleep time that happens before the euthanasia injection is facilitated, because a lot of times families want to stay present for that, but they want their pet sleeping to be their final moments and not necessarily the final breath. And that's okay. That's okay. It's really whatever is going to be best for the family and for the pet. But they want the choice to be present. They want their pet sleeping in their final moments, if possible. That came up to the top. And they want the experience to be as pain-free and anxiety-free as possible, which usually lends itself to their pet sleeping in those final moments. They want help with pre-planning, as we mentioned. And then just because we can, because you mentioned home euthanasia, I'll say what actually rounded out the top five things was the option for home euthanasia. But we didn't want any veterinary teams to feel like they were failing in some way because they couldn't offer that, right? It's not available in every part of the country or the world. But when it's possible, we should be asking families, where do they want to gather? Do they want to come into the hospital? Or would they rather have someone on the veterinary team go to the home? Or can we leverage some of the wonderful home euthanasia and hospice services that are now in the country to go there and facilitate a peaceful passing, you know, wherever the pet and family will be most comfortable? So those really were the top five.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And so something that your work has also looked at is what a good euthanasia looks like for the staff, for the veterinary professionals. And I know that there, or I expect there'll be some of those in the audience listening. Do you mind talking a little bit about that? What do veterinary professionals look for in a good euthanasia?
Perfect. And we studied that too. We asked veterinarians how you define a good death. And not too surprisingly, they lined up pretty closely with the pet owners, with another angle in there and wanting to make sure that everything is technically smooth, right? So when they're giving the sedation ahead of time to help the patient sleep, that there's no pain, that it's very, welcomed in effectively, efficiently in a reasonable amount of time. So veterinary teams like that, they of course appreciate when the euthanasia solution is given that it's effective and fast and no complications, right? That's very important to the veterinary teams, is that they can do everything possible to minimize complications at the time of death. It's rare for me to speak with a veterinarian who has not had a challenging euthanasia, right? We're all likely to have one at some point in our career. And those challenges come from the medical aspect, or maybe not, you know, connecting in with the client quite as much as they wanted to connect, or it just the communication just kind of fell flat for some reason. That can leave veterinary teams feeling rather haunted. You know, it can be upsetting. And so they would love everything to go just perfectly. And I wrote a blog a couple of years ago on the perfect euthanasia, and it's on my CADAInternational.com website, just called The Perfect Euthanasia. And what made it perfect for me as the veterinarian and for the client and the patient is that we connected on a personal level. All of us connected, right? We all had our own bond. We had an opportunity to share stories and to slow down and really settle into that moment. And the owners felt like they were making the right choice. That is important to veterinarians, that when they're working with clients, that there's not a lot of doubt that's remaining, right? We want to know that this is the right choice at the right time. That can be important. And then the medical aspect of it, that, you know, the pet was very comfortable, that there was no pain, that they just welcomed those drugs, and that the euthanasia was very peaceful. That's what we're all striving for. So when that doesn't happen, veterinary teams can be left, you know, upset and wishing that they could go back in time. I always say my superhero power would be time travel, to go back in time and make things better. But of course, that doesn't work that way. So how can veterinary teams then, if things aren't going well, like maybe they routinely have some pain issues or euthanasia seems to take longer than what it should, how can they as a team get together and debrief and improve their euthanasia standard operating procedures, right? The way that they deliver euthanasia across that hospital or across that service, that each time they're asking themselves, how do we get better and better and better until they're achieving what I'll call borderline perfection. And I say borderline perfection because we don't want to put such, you know, undue stress on that, that it's got to be perfect every time. Otherwise, we have fallen short. But I think we need to strive for the best euthanasia experience possible and then make adaptations and changes when we know we can do better. So what is the saying? When we know better, we do better. And I think it's also interesting to note how many veterinary teams are now gravitating more towards euthanasia work, and veterinarians in particular, because of all of the abilities that they have with their licensure to provide it in the hospital setting and in the home setting, and are really finding a calling to do this type of work. That only happens when you're doing it right. Otherwise, who would want to do more euthanasia than necessary? So I'm just so pleased and delighted that veterinary teams are leaning in towards euthanasia, doing it the right way, not shying away from it and saying, we can't do this. Instead, they're saying, we will do this and we're going to do it the right way.
And this ties in really nicely to the topic of compassion fatigue. I think it just may concern some veterinary students, knowing that euthanasia is part of their day-to-day, and that is a big part of why, you know, they get compassion stress and compassion fatigue. I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit. I know you have some, is it certification or specialized training in compassion fatigue? How do you do this work day-to-day and combat becoming fatigued or burned out?
Probably the best way to share information about educational resources around this, let's just start with this first. There are certification programs to learn about compassion fatigue. There's a few of them out there. I took training to be a certified compassion fatigue professional from a group called IATP, International Association for Trauma Professionals. That's where I got my certification. And it was a short course, but it taught me a lot about compassion fatigue. And then veterinary professionals can also learn from University of Tennessee's Veterinary Social Work Program. I've taken a lot of their courses. And yes, there are veterinary social workers who are a wonderful part of the interdisciplinary team in vet med that can also be a perfect support for clients and the team themselves, right? The veterinary team that might be struggling with burnout or compassion fatigue itself. So really quick, the way that I define compassion fatigue is the way that I was taught is that it's really two components. It's burnout and secondary traumatic stress. Secondary traumatic stress comes from watching the primary traumatic stress of another person or another animal. And when you're amped up at the same time, right? When you're really anxious or you're kind of feeling like you're just amped up is the best word that I can pick there, rather than being very calm and very relaxed. So if you're calm and relaxed and you're watching the primary traumatic stress of another, you're less likely to internalize it as secondary traumatic stress. And when we're doing euthanasia work, we're often watching the primary traumatic stress of others, right? We're watching the emotional stress. Could be for the patient, it could be physical trauma, you know, hit by cars to, you know, struggling to breathe to seizures, whatever that it is. And if we're not in the right physical space to witness that, then we put ourselves at risk of compassion fatigue, right? Again, secondary traumatic stress and then burnout. Burnout is burnout, right? When we have too many demands and not enough resources. And that is kind of true of many different aspects of life in general, from professional life to personal life, it just depends. But what veterinary teams can do is to learn how to stay calm and, you know, mindfulness and self-regulation, good emotional intelligence, to learn emotional intelligence and self-regulation to be able to be in those emotional spaces and not have it start to be a drain, right? Empathetic strain, I've heard the terms, lots of different concepts, but to really be resilient to that, what's in front of us. And instead, because we're calm, because we're in control of our thoughts and of our actions, we now have the ability to make such a stronger connection with our clients and with our patients and achieve what I like to refer to as euharmony, right? When we're talking about euthanasia, is this idea of euharmony, spelled EU harmony, like euthanasia, EU, euharmony. So that when veterinary teams are walking into an appointment, they're calm and they're collected. They're ready to deliver their best medicine and their compassion, but doing it in a way that when they walk out of that appointment, they're just as balanced as when they walked in, and potentially even better, right? So how can we leverage what we consider the one of the hardest appointments that we do in veterinary medicine to actually help us to become better veterinarians, to give us a chance to reset in that moment, to see the beauty of the human-animal bond, again, to be calm. And hey, maybe we can leverage those comfort rooms as being a bit of kind of a spa room where everybody wants to settle in and where you got nature around and you know, beautiful images of the human-animal bond, to then again, walk out of that appointment and be able to maybe step right back into another one. You know, that we might have four euthanasias that day. And can we do that? Well, not everyone can, but those of us who are taking care of ourselves are more inclined to be able to do it. And again, speaks to those of us who do specifically euthanasia end-of-life work, that we can help 5-6 families a day and get up and be able to do it the next day. It's because we have been well-trained on how to protect ourselves and we've got those skills. So I'm a big advocate for having a picture of the human-animal bond right outside of a euthanasia room at a hospital, whether or not it's a specialty hospital, ER, GP, general practice. Have a picture of the human-animal bond, and every veterinary team member has to stop and reflect on it before they walk in the room. Take a deep breath, relax the body, reflect on what's on the other side of that door. What are some of the triggers that might negatively affect our emotional health? And then be ready to walk in and be an angel, right? Who doesn't want to be an angel every day, all day long, and meet families in their darkest times and come out at the other side of that potentially better than when they walked in? So I think we've got a great opportunity to start to leverage euthanasia for the right reasons at the right time, you know, releasing a pet from their body when they're suffering and use that as that helper's high to remind us that we're doing good work and that we don't have to be, you know, weakened because of it.
I just love the way that you've described veterinarians as being an angel in those moments, because I suspect there are those veterinary professionals that view themselves more as a grim reaper going into the room and bringing about death. And I think that that's such a beautiful way to change the way that they think about what occurs during a euthanasia and seeing it as a gift almost that they're able to provide to these people and their pets who have lived this beautiful life together. And they have this bond that's been nurtured and has healed both of them, I'm sure, throughout the lifetime. And that you're able to sort of honor that by thinking of yourself as an angel in that moment.
When we think of animals as soulmates, we have to look at their life as a book, right? We're writing a story together, and every chapter is a different part of that animal's life. And that last chapter will include death, no matter what, it's going to happen. So what a blessing that these veterinary teams, whether or not it's one person or two people, who's ever there in that room, can deliver a peaceful end-of-life experience and help to write that chapter in the right way and not look at it as this is a tragedy, but this was a beautiful story and that endings matter. So let's take it from that angle and know that that family is hopefully lucky to have us there, lucky that we can offer this type of care in this moment. And that, yeah, it's not a grim reaper moment. It's a gift. It's a gift in those final, you know, in the final moment of life, having it peaceful, sharing stories, potentially laughing, right? It doesn't always have to be dark. It can be moments of lightness. And that's important. And that the veterinary team gets to be a part of that and to help to close that chapter in the right way, because again, endings do matter.
And I love that book analogy. I've heard it before. And I see us as pet owners, when we've lost a pet, we constantly reread that book over and over and over again, reliving memories, reliving every chapter. And inevitably, that last chapter is hard to read every time, but hopefully you can read it and smile a little bit too about it was beautiful. It was exactly what I would have wanted for them. And yeah, I love thinking about our life with our pets as a story.
Thank you. Thank you. That's well said. And it's to be honored, right? It's to be honored and protected. And we said before that not all euthanasias are perfect, right? There are challenges that happen. But if we keep our compassion as veterinary professionals and our confidence and keep control, keep calm, we will be able to carry through, right? Keep calm and carry on. And I've had some challenging euthanasias where the clients didn't think they were challenging at all. They thought they were beautiful. It was just my perception of it. But again, it comes back down to that or around to that compassion. Right? Compassion is empathy in action. How can I help in this moment? How can I be an angel and ask the right questions and listen to stories and just be a friend? Be a friend in this moment. That is what has made me gravitate towards this work, is it's special. It's just special. And it does make me worry or feel a little bit sad when I do hear about veterinary professionals who don't like performing euthanasia, that they just haven't seen another side of it yet that's possible. So that's why I keep doing the work that I do to help them understand what a good euthanasia looks like. In fact, I'll share a quick story. I had a veterinary student come and shadow me here at my little comfort center in Colorado. And she came to me because she was crying regularly during euthanasias at the teaching hospital at her university. And they said, why don't you go spend a little bit of time with Dr. Cooney and see what she does and maybe offer a little bit different perspective. And that student spent a day with me. And after watching her first euthanasia here at my center, she went into the restroom here and she cried. But when she came out, she shared with me that she was crying tears of joy, that this is how euthanasia can be, right? This is the possibility of it when we really put that bond front and center and slow down, remove that clinical aspect. And again, just really lean into it. Don't lean away from it, lean into it. And she was shown a new path that day, a new possibility. And it was just one of my best days ever as a teacher.
Oh, yeah. You talked about the training academy, the euthanasia training academy, or you mentioned it. Would you mind talking about that a little bit? What it is, what you do?
So the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy, which is CAETA for short, C-A-E-T-A. CAETA was started in 2017 to offer more education around euthanasia for veterinary students, for veterinary technician students, and for professionals who are already out in practice, right? That maybe didn't get a lot of education during their schooling. So how can they make it better? And so to date, we have taught people from all over the world. In fact, we moved beyond veterinarians and technicians and already licensed professionals. We're teaching veterinary social workers, practice managers, grief counselors, veterinary assistants, anyone who might be in the space, also including shelter staff, animal shelter staff have taken our courses as well. So we're not licensing anyone to perform euthanasia that isn't already licensed by their state or province or country, but we are just making what they know about euthanasia better, right? Taking it to the next level. So we have, oh my goodness, at this point, over 40 hours worth of education, everything from our 10-hour Peaceful Euthanasia Master Program that helps to certify veterinarians as certified peaceful euthanasia veterinarians or technicians and support staff as certified peaceful euthanasia professionals. And so that's our master program. And then we have hours of content on everything from home euthanasia to emotionally intelligent euthanasia to information on livestock and like companion livestock and horse euthanasia. So we try to help everyone learn about good euthanasia when it comes to companion animals. And then we actually have something quite unique. We have 8 hours, I think it is, of recorded euthanasias that families were willing to share their euthanasia story with others to learn from. And we recorded those euthanasias here at my comfort center in Colorado, and we call them our honored stories. So those families created a legacy from the actual euthanasia of their pet to teach others. So that's a special part of what we do. But all the way through it, it's try to make the technique better for the veterinary professionals, try to improve communication skills and, you know, understand what compassion fatigue is and team well-being. And at the end of the day, when practices take this, and they can be practice certified too, so veterinary hospital or practice can be certified end of life, peaceful end of life practice, they're going to put together a manual that all of the team can follow to pretty much help ensure that good euthanasia will be at least aimed for, right? Not a guarantee, but aimed for. And we love that. So we encourage everyone who takes the program to, yeah, do a manual to have something like that set that they can follow. But I love this program. We now teach, I think, 15 veterinary colleges and maybe about half that for the tech colleges. We teach international. So we're an international academy and we teach at conferences and do webinars. And it's the only one like it out there. And it's because we've got the leaders of the field bringing it to those who need it, to the audience who needs it. And we're doing research as well. So we're trying to elevate what we know about euthanasia so that it's got good science and validation behind it.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. I'll put the contact information in the show notes. Are there other resources that you would recommend for those listeners that are interested in learning more about this topic?
For pet owners, there is a fair amount of resources out there that could be Googled. First of all, just, you know, supporting myself at the end of life, supporting my pet's journey. Lap of Love has a lot of good resources out there. They're one of the largest home hospice and euthanasia services for pets in the country, or I think they are the largest. They have a lot of resources for pet owners, and there are a couple other companies that also have those. So just doing good targeted Google searches, I think, makes sense, right? Learning about my pet's end-of-life journey or decision-making at the end of life. CADA right now doesn't have necessarily a lot of resources for pet owners, but we will start to have more of that in the coming years. We are still very strong for the veterinary professionals. For veterinary professionals, there are a couple of associations out there that could be good resources. The first one that comes to mind is the International Association for Animal Hospice and Palliative Care. They teach a lot about, of course, anything related to end of life for companion animals. Again, that's the International Association for Animal Hospice and Palliative Care. Then there is the World Veterinary Palliative Medicine Organization. A lot of information about palliative medicine and also about euthanasia. And then there are quite a few books these days for veterinary professionals on hospice, palliative care, euthanasia, of course, grief support, that could also be a good resource for pet owners. So for the most part, a lot of the books that are available for vet med are also available for pet owners that might want to learn more about, you know, just the complexities of end-of-life care. And yeah, that's kind of what's coming to mind at the moment, but the IHPC has a lot of resources and the other groups will as well. So just have fun. Fun is the right word, but, you know, pre-planning and exploring this information to help you to prepare. But again, knowledge is power. So I'm all for it.
Absolutely. And like you said earlier in the podcast, I think it really helps remove some of that fear associated with end of life when you know what to expect. So I think it's really Absolutely. Valuable to have this information before you even have to think about it.
And it seems strange to start to think about it for pet owners before their pet gets their first gray hair. You know, like how early is too early to start to think about it. But in general, there's no harm starting early because you never know what life is going to be. We don't know how long this book is, right? How many chapters we're going to have. So, you know, early disease onset occurs and traumas happen and it's just unfortunate. So the more we can learn about it early on in our pet's life, the better. But certainly when they reach the senior years, what is it, 7 years for most dogs, 8 years for most cats, just right around that area, and then different ages for different animals as well, just to start to say, what should I know, right? What should I learn? What can I take in? And again, be curious with it. Talk to other people, right? Talk to other people who have had to make choices like this. There's a lot of different Facebook groups, a lot of blogs out there, books that people have written about their own pet's end-of-life journey, and just, you know, learn from others, especially if this is your first pet and you've never gone through it before. But I think the real takeaway here is that The more you know, the more in control you will be. But that said, death is something that's very uncontrollable, right? So we as animal lovers have to acknowledge that death will come in any way that it wants to. And yes, sometimes we have control over it with euthanasia, you know, stepping in before our pet gets into a crisis or really has significant suffering that can no longer be managed. But it's okay to relinquish some control, to let go of it in your pet's final moments, because death is its own thing and death is a process and it's beautiful in and of itself.
I would love to ask before I let you go if you've ever had an animal soulmate.
Oh, I've had many, but the first one that comes to mind is my yellow lab, part Australian shepherd dog, Sally, who I got when I was early into my college years. So she helped me through my degrees all the way through vet med. She was a wonderful dog, just a ton of fun. She would ride or run next to me when I would ride my bike, right? Off leash. She was just well-trained. We were just in sync. She was a good girl. And she helped to raise my kids up to the age of, I think, 5 for my oldest one and maybe 1 for my youngest. So they know her. We've got pictures of her with them. And she was just a wonderful, wonderful dog. So hard to top Sally. But these days I've got a black lab named Eleanor. I've got two pugs, one named Darby and one named Loretta Lynn, and they're a lot of fun.
That's amazing. All right. Well, I really appreciate your time. I think that you have done some amazing work in this space. I think that this work is going to continue to grow as more people become in tune with euthanasia the way that you have. So I really appreciate your time here. And yeah, keep doing what you're doing. It really is a gift that you're able to provide to our animal soulmates.
Thank you. And thank you for this platform that you've given to share this information. And I hope that it inspires everyone to go out and learn what you can about end of life. And I'm here to be a resource for you with the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy.
And I guess I should ask, where can people find you? Do you have an Instagram or a social media presence, or what can people do if they wanted to reach out?
Thank you. Kata has a Facebook page. We have Instagram. We're on LinkedIn. And then, of course, we just have our website, which is katainternational.com. And we've got an admin page there, or like kind of a contact us page that my staff can connect with me directly as well. But I'm an open book. I'm easy to find.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Cooney. So something kind of beautiful happened while I was reviewing the video for this episode. When we recorded, I remember Frank was just not as chill as he usually is. He was being kind of needy, but I really didn't pay much attention to it because I was so focused on the interview and my notes and making sure that everything ran smoothly. What I ended up seeing in the playback was that as Dr. Cooney was describing what happens during a euthanasia, Frank was very focused on me. He was lying on the bed close to where I was sitting, and he nudged my hand a few times. And something that I mentioned in the episode was that it was hard not to reflect on Amira's euthanasia while listening to Dr. Cooney speak about the procedure. I just think that that's kind of natural, but I just wasn't letting myself feel it because I wanted to stay present and engaged in the interview. But Frank was clearly picking up on his mom needing a little extra care and comfort. And I didn't even realize what he was doing until right now. Dogs are just so amazing. Frank has such a beautiful soul. Oh, I'm getting emotional. He's crazy, don't get me wrong, but he has just so much love in him. Ooh, okay. All of the resources that Dr. Cooney mentioned can be found in the show notes. For those veterinary professionals in the audience, I strongly recommend CADA, that's the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy, for specialized training in peaceful euthanasia. And if you're a student who wants to receive more robust training in euthanasia and you're not really getting that at your institution, you can chat with your administration and just see if there's an opportunity to bring CADA to your particular institution. Thank you again to Dr. Cooney for chatting with me. Now I've got to go find that mush of a pit bull and give him a giant hug. See you guys next week. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Animal Soulmates podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a positive rating or review. Follow us on Instagram at Animal Soulmates Pod for updates and pictures of our guests with their beautiful animal soulmates. This podcast is produced by Citizens of Sound. Our theme song is Mastering the Art by Big Score Audio. Have a story that would be a good fit for the show? Send me an email at animalsoulmatespod@outlook.com. That's Animal Soulmates with an S, P-O-D, at outlook.com. Finally, are you thinking about adding an animal to your family? Why not consider adoption through your local animal shelter? There are plenty of dogs and cats just waiting to become someone's animal soulmate. See you next time!